This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to our weekly series about inequality in the Baltimore region, The Lines Between Us. For several months, we've been looking at inequalities in the criminal justice system. Today, we're continuing to look at criminal justice by focusing on a different approach called restorative justice. We begin on 33rd Street in Baltimore. Casey Reed, a 21-year-old geriatric nursing assistant, lives in the Better Waverly neighborhood. A month ago, she was walking down 33rd Street, talking on her cell phone, when a 13-year-old boy snatched her phone and ran down Barclay Street. She chased him, then called police, who caught and arrested him. The boy, Darwin Adams, had no prior record. Instead of sending the case through the juvenile justice system, police decided to refer it to the Community Conferencing Center. Casey Reed, Darwin, and Darwin's mom, Toy Harris, met several weeks ago with a facilitator from the center to talk about what happened and how to make things right. This approach to justice, giving all parties affected a voice and working out how to move forward, is called restorative justice. In a few minutes, we'll talk more about restorative justice with Lauren Abramson, executive director of the Community Conferencing Center. But first, a conversation with Toy Harris, Darwin's mom, about her experience with the process. Darwin preferred not to talk to us. Casey Reed, whose cell phone was snatched, initially agreed to talk with us, but did not show up for our scheduled interview. I asked Toy Harris whether anything like her son's arrest had happened before.
Never. Very first time. So it really, you know, shocked me. You know, it hurt my heart, but at the same time, I was like, okay, he was out there doing some stupid things and something happened.
So you're waiting to pick him up from baby booking, mm-hmm. from juvenile justice, mm-hmm. and you're thinking all these things,
yes.
and I guess you do pick him up.
Yes.
And then what happened next?
When I looked at him, he couldn't even look at me in my eyes, but I just looked at him and I gave him a disappointing look, you know, and I said, Darwin, I can't believe you did anything like this. I said, what was you thinking? And he just kept on apologizing. I'm sorry, Mom, you know, and just waiting for him to come out. He said, Mom, they was mean to me. I said, you need to experience it. I said, because this is nothing like how it will be in adult system. I told him so. I said, they was being mean to y'all for a reason to deter y'all from coming down here.
So that day, a month ago, did you think he was going to be charged? Did you think it was over? What were you
expecting?
No,
because before we left there, the lady said they had a program. It was a deterrence program for children for first-time offenders.
Community conferencing.
Yeah, it was another name they gave it, but then the community conferencing came in.
And what is community conferencing in your experience?
Okay, community conference is where you have a one-on-one with the victim and the person that committed the crime to the victim to discuss why did you do it, who else did it affect, and how did you feel after you have done the crime, and what did you expect them to do to you because of you committing a crime towards them.
The young woman whose phone was snatched is Casey Reed. She lives in that general area in the Better Waverly neighborhood. And I gather that you and she and Darwin had a meeting.
Yes.
So tell me about the meeting.
The meeting was excellent. We had the meeting at Waverly Library, Free Ina Pratt Library on 33rd. Darwin sat across from her, face to face, and then they had a mediator there. She sat on the other end across face to face to me. So she more or less asked the questions, and she mainly gave each one of the opportunity to tell the story. Darwin went first, then Casey went next, and then she asked me, how did I feel about it? You know, and she also asked me to express my feelings towards Darwin, of why and he committed the crime, how you felt about it. And then also, how did I feel how Casey gave a decision not to prosecute him?
How did you feel about Casey's decision not to prosecute?
I was very happy, a little overwhelmed, because I came there being optimistic of if I have to pay punitive damages for the phone, because they never recovered the phone, and was she going to press charges? So I really didn't know exactly what was going to happen. And once she said it, it brought tears to my eyes because I'm saying she's giving this child a second chance because she didn't have to. And she was very mature on what she was saying to him and everything she said to him. I really didn't have to say too much to Darwin because she had said it for me.
Like what?
She was more or less saying, why disappoint your parent? And then you don't know who other person that was damaged from that, because she said her mother was sickly, and because of that happening, it sent her straight to the hospital. So she was saying, when you do things, think about who else that it hurts.
Did Casey Reed explain why she made the decision she made not to press charges?
I think just from talking to Dalvin, because Dalvin wrote her a letter apologizing.
Tell me about the letter.
The letter mainly spoke to her. He more or less said, I have learned my lesson for stealing your phone, and this was my first and last time committing this crime. And I really apologize, and I hope you accept my apology.
Because Casey Reed did not demand restitution, mm-hmm. I mean, some people are going to listen to this and say, hey, he didn't have to replace the phone, he didn't have to pay anything, he didn't have to do community service. I mean, there's no real punishment. Is he learning anything from this?
He's learning, because he has to be in a house by 10 during the summer hours, and he has to get his chores done by 2.
Are these your rules? Are these Casey's rules?
These are my rules.
The police rules?
These are my rules.
These are your rules.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How do you think this has shaped who your son will become?
I think it's a lesson taught, but I don't think he really understands. He understands that it was a crime that he committed, but I don't think he really understands how important and how it affected the people that was a part of it. I don't think he really feels as though it didn't bother me or affected his father or any other family members. I don't think he's really registering how serious it was.
Toy, thank you for walking us through this.
You're welcome.
Toy Harris. Her son, Darwin, stole Casey Reed's cell phone a month ago. With a police referral, they used an alternative approach to the criminal justice system called restorative justice to decide the consequences of the crime. On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. This is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning. To help us better understand the idea of restorative justice, we turn now to Lauren Abramson. She's founder and executive director of the Community Conferencing Center, the organization that facilitated the meeting among Toy Harris, her son Darwin, and Casey Reed. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Why do we need something like restorative justice that operates differently from the traditional criminal justice system?
Oh, I think there's a lot of reasons why we need this. Our courts are overburdened. I think any prosecutor or public defender or judge will tell you that. The system is biased based on how much money you make and what color your skin is. There's a lot of documentation about that. And the other really big part of why we need this is because we've got an adversarial criminal justice system that is focused on identifying two things: who did it and how can we punish them. And with restorative justice, we ask a very different set of questions. We ask, who's been affected by this, and how can the harm be repaired? And when you ask a different set of questions, you get a very different outcome. So with our current punitive system, adversarial system, it's costly. You've got to hire lawyers. And they're trying to win the case for their client, who, if the prosecutor wins, the offender is punished and separated from the victim. The victim has no say in deciding the outcomes. They don't even really have a role in the court and in the justice process. And then what happens is everybody ends up oftentimes more angry than when they went in. The person who caused the harm is upset about having gone to jail. There's all sorts of research that shows when people go to jail, what they learn is how to be better criminals, because they're in jail with a lot of other people who are doing often more serious things than they've done.
And so within all that, there's a lot of powerful points you just made. What for you is the key difference between restorative justice and the traditional criminal
system? I think the key thing is that it's about human beings, that crime is about relationships that have been damaged as opposed to just a law that's been broken. that the man who, at 11 o'clock at night, the single father who went to Rite Aid to pick up a prescription for his sick daughter and accidentally left the keys in his car and the kid stole the car, who comes out at 11 o'clock at night and can't get back to his sick daughter, and there's all sorts of people affected by this, that it's not just the broken, that the law was broken, it's that he was really affected by that and his daughter was very affected by that. And the young people who did that really deserve an opportunity to learn how their actions have affected other people so that they can learn how to do things in a kinder way in the future. Because ultimately, we all, you know, it's about building a sense of accountability to each other and responsibility for ourselves.
How long has this approach been used?
Well, I learned about it 19 years ago from some folks in Australia, and they adapted it from the Maori in New Zealand. So similar types of justice processes have been used in Aboriginal cultures on this planet for hundreds of years. We've been doing it in Baltimore officially for 15 years.
How many people have used your system?
15,000 people in Baltimore have successfully resolve their own crimes and conflicts using community conferencing.
15,000 includes both offenders, victims,
right. Family members. Right. And the thing about this that's different than a typical and classic mediation, it's similar in that it's a way for people to resolve the issue themselves instead of having an authority tell them what they need to do to fix it. But what's different is that we include those who've caused the harm, those who've been harmed, and their respective supporters and anybody else who's been affected by this.
The situation that Toy Harris told us about, is that typical of the kind of cases that you see?
Happily, I'm happy to say we actually take not just first-time offenders, but we also encourage the court system to divert young people like the 12-year-old who's had 8 prior offenses. And our reasoning is, look, whatever's being done now is not deterring them from doing what they're doing. Why not try something different? And so we get misdemeanor and felony offenses diverted to community conferencing. And 95% of the time, this group of victims and offenders and their supporters are able to come up with a written agreement deciding how to fix it and abide by that agreement. There's been 60% lower reoffending at about 1/10 the cost of what we currently do. So the other piece of why we need something different than our current system is that it's really costly. And we've got ways of fixing this ourselves in our neighborhoods. Like how Ms. Harris said, community conference happened at the Waverly Library. You know, they happen in the neighborhoods where people live. And there are people deciding it for themselves at 1/10 of the cost of what we currently do.
On Maryland Morning at 8:01, this is The Lines Between Us. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Lauren Abramson, founder and executive director of the Community Conferencing Center. We're talking about restorative justice, the approach they take to handling crimes outside the courts. How do cases find their way to you?
I'd like to say that we're indiscriminate about from where we'll take referrals. We get neighborhood conflicts. We get a lot of cases from the schools. School police will refer cases before they arrest kids from the schools. City police, Department of Juvenile Services, and the state's attorney's office and the juvenile courts. We get referrals from all those.
And you said in 95% of the cases, there's an agreement, written agreement, that people abide by. What happens in the 5%?
It gets returned to the source from that referred it, and they will handle it in the way that they normally did.
And how often is there some kind of restitution or compensation for the victim paid?
Monetary restitution, I would say, in about 15% to 20% of the cases.
Hmm.
Interestingly, a fair amount of the time when victims come in wanting monetary restitution and then they meet this young person and they meet their families and they see what they're struggling with, they end up saying, you know what? That's not as important as that heartfelt apology I just got from you. The restitution is not always monetary. I mean, the emotional piece is so important. So it's not always money.
When I spoke with Toy Harris she surprised me when I asked about who has more say in what happens to an offender.
Yeah, it seems as if the victim has more say.
They have more say.
You're okay with that?
Not really, but at the same time, when you commit a crime, you got to pay the time. That's how I feel. I have a degree in criminal justice, so I feel very hard on people that commit crimes because you had a choice.
Two things. Toy's son didn't have to pay for the cell phone he stole. He didn't have to do community service. The punitive aspect that's in the criminal justice system was absent in this case. So some people would say without a punishment, he's more likely to do it again.
So I would say it's about accountability. And there were consequences. I'm not sure exactly what their agreement was for that community conference, but my guess is that there was an apology.
Mm-hmm. There definitely was.
And was there an agreement that he wouldn't do it again? Do you know?
She didn't tell me that specifically. I assume so.
I mean, I'd be curious.
His letter, he said, this is the first and only. This is the first time I did this crime and I won't do it again.
So he
promised in his letter of apology.
There's a lot of things in the agreement that are consequences. And the thing about the agreement is that everybody in that circle decides what is fair. I know that I'm curious why she might have felt that the victim had more say. Because the facilitator will always, whenever anybody agrees, suggests an agreement point, will always say to everybody in the circle, does everybody think that's fair?
But in this case, and maybe it's typical, it was basically the victim who decided not to press charges. It was the victim who opened this door for this young man. And, I mean, a crime is an offense against a victim. It's also an offense against society. So why should how he's treated depend so much on the attitude of this one young woman?
I mean, it's interesting. I think people's sense of how the court system works is very different than how it actually works. You know, there's this sense that, oh, if I go to court, this kid's going to get their just punishment for what they did. Well, the fact is that half of juvenile court cases get dismissed. Where's the punishment there? Or where's, more importantly, where's the accountability there and where's the opportunity for that young person to learn that what they did affected people really harshly and how to learn how to do it differently?
Our producer, Matt Purdy, spoke with Baltimore State's Attorney Greg Bernstein, whose office, one of the ones you mentioned, refers juvenile offenders to your center. We asked him whether crimes by adults or more serious crimes are ever referred, and Bernstein told us this.
When you have a crime that involves substantial violence, you know, be it a shooting or a serious assault or even a homicide, you know, these are very, very, you know, difficult cases with strong emotional components to them, and then you get into more issues of, you know, deterrence and just maintaining public safety in terms of having to approach those cases in a much more traditional way.
Do you think restorative justice approach could work with more serious crimes?
I really do. You know, my question is always, how well is what you're doing currently working at deterring crime? And how well is that doing at keeping public safety? Because if what we're doing now is really working that well, then by all means, carry on with it. I think that in many, many cases, we could benefit as a community and as a city and as a society by doing it differently, by allowing people to make decisions for themselves, to understand really the impact of their behavior on others. And to have there be an acknowledgement that relationships have been damaged as opposed to just laws broken.
Lauren, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Sheila.
Lauren Abramson is founder and executive director of the Community Conferencing Center. We've got more information about restorative justice on our website, linesbetweenus.org. More of this interview there, too. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on The Lines Between Us, Tom Hall visits a neighborhood where ex-offenders are learning construction skills to turn themselves around. and turn around the neighborhood at the same time. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm Assistant Producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Mornings, the Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome back to The Lines Between Us. The whole idea of this series is to try and grasp how inequality takes root in a region, in particular here in the Baltimore region. We looked at housing to see why some neighborhoods thrive while others depreciate and become spotted with vacants. We looked at economic opportunity, what's standing in the way of upward mobility for our poorest residents. And we looked at criminal justice, particularly the challenges of reentry, the barriers ex-offenders find when they return from prison to a poor neighborhood to start their lives over. Today, I'm out in the Greater Rosemont neighborhood of West Baltimore with some people who think they can kill two birds with one stone, housing depreciation and the economic challenges of reentry. Group Ministries has a program that teaches ex-offenders construction skills by having them rehab vacant homes in the neighborhood. Skills for the people, better housing for the neighborhood. It's like the Community Development Corporation model that rehabilitated the Patterson Park area with a twist. I'm here in West Baltimore at the corner of Edmondson Avenue and North Franklin Town Road at the headquarters of Group Ministries. And joining me is the Reverend Horace Smith. He's the president and CEO of Group Ministries. Mike Bailey is from the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health Center for Communication Programs. He's the program manager. Anton Pritchett is a community liaison with Group Ministries. Welcome to you all. And Reverend Smith, let me start with you. A little bit later, we're going to be heading out to a site, which I assume is, you know, an example of the kind of work you do. What are we going to find out there?
What we would find is that individuals who have went through our school, which we have a school, and we are educating individuals as well as getting them entry-level skills in electricity, plumbing, and carpentry, of which a few of our guys have been able to enter to the union as journeymen. And we do have a few success cases with those individuals who have went through it, because we do something a little bit different than just the jobs. You know, we do conflict resolutions. We do those type of life skills things that will help individuals to make a better choices and decisions in their lives, because we believe that we can teach them to be a plumber, but we want them to be a plumber who makes good decisions and someone not, you know, going back to some of those old behaviors. Mm-hmm.
How many houses are you rehabbing at the moment?
At the moment, we're rehabbing our second house that we received funding from a very prominent private foundation, of which gave us $107,000 for the first house, of which you're sitting in right now. That this house was vacant. This house was renovated by ex-offenders in our first program. When we came into this house, half of the roof was off of this house, and certainly you're sitting in a house that was done by ex-offenders. I grew up in West Baltimore, right here in this area, and my whole thing was coming back to my community and make a difference. I used heroin for over 20-some years. I've been clean now for almost 30 years. And my whole thing was coming back to my community and making a difference, because when I used to come home from jail, you know what I mean, I went back to the same old things. You know, I came back home with a good idea, you know, excited, but those things of life, you know, kick back in, you know, like rent, food, you know what I mean, those types of things. And most of the time I found myself back into the old behaviors.
Anton Pritchett, where are the guys living when they're working on these houses?
Well, we do have some living in the transitional houses for the most part. Transitional housing.
And Mike Bailey, how many folks have passed through the program at this point, and how many houses have you done up to this juncture?
Well, in terms of people, we've had 61 that have graduated through our program in various capacities, and only two have returned to prison. We have roughly a 60% employment rate so far and a 90% graduation rate from the program itself. At this time, in terms of houses, I think we have five temporary and four that we've been in the process of rehabbing.
Well, now we're going to head out to a site and talk to some of the guys who are out there working on houses. Thanks very much, Reverend Horace Smith, Mike Bailey, Anton Pritchett. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. You're now at the location. 1121 and 1119.
So Poplar Grove is the both the geographic and symbolic center of this community, and we felt if we could just stabilize this area, focus our efforts here, that perhaps we could create some sort of ripple effect, and hopefully it'll begin to go into other parts of the neighborhood. But this is our starting point. These are two that we've rehabbed. One's our trading school, and one we're in the process of rehabbing.
This is the first house that we did 1121. It had probably been empty for about 4 or 5 years. It was certainly when we went in there, it looks nothing like it does now. We completely renovated it. We're most proud of the house next door that we just did. This is one of our model houses that will be our model house. We want to make this block a model.
Right, let's take a look inside and see the kind of work you guys are doing.
Everything on here was redone. We redid the whole porch as well as the roofing here. Kind of hard to describe what the house looked like when we came in, but believe me, it was a dump. This house is a little different because we did a redesign with this. We changed the stairway of this house. We made it more open and more community friendly. This way we can have like community meetings in here. So, you know, most of our buildings we do use for multiple purposes. And this was all done by ex-offenders and individuals in the program. Oh, Victor. Yeah, Victor. Yeah, Victor just came. Yeah, come on. Yeah, Victor. Victor is one of our new individuals. Victor came to us a few months ago, and he came into our jobs development program looking for a job. And one of the things that we found about Victor is that he showed up every day. He was really excited about changing his position in life and been really consistent with it. So we started him off on the maintenance crew, and now he has entered into the school.
Victor, what in this house here, what are the kinds of things that you've been involved with in the rehab of this particular property?
Well, in this house, I just got in on we built these cabinets for the house next door, and I just got finished painting it. So basically, because I only been here for about a month and a half.
And what's this past month and a half meant for you personally?
It's been good because when I came to Rev, he didn't like judge me or anything. He got me from where I was in life, and it's only been uphill from then on.
Did you grow up in this neighborhood?
Yes.
And how long were you away? How long were you incarcerated?
For 3 years.
Is the community of other guys, the fact that you all are working in this situation and you've come from, you know, similar challenges, is that a big part of what's helpful to you?
Yes, it's because we all help each other to stay focused on what we're trying to accomplish. And if someone get weak, they know they got somebody they could call to give them some positive input on whatever problem they have, you know. And that's real, real important, you know.
Are there skills that you have now that you did not have when you first came back to the neighborhood?
Yes.
When you got out?
Yes, it's like roofing. We do roofing. I've never did that. So now, I picked that up. So I've been doing that. So yeah, I learned a lot in this last month and a half.
Well, congratulations, man. It's really, really, it's
Thanks
great to
lot.
Meet you. And you're doing great work here. It looks beautiful in
Thanks
here.
A lot.
Thank you, man.
So now we're in a different property, another property that you have renovated and that you're using. There's an office here in one of the rooms. Where are we standing now, Red?
This was the second house that we received money from one of the prominent foundations here. Here again, we use the same model using ex-offenders to train them in order to do entry-level work. But in addition, we also use our students who are already in school to do this type of work. What we've also done here, because of the limited space, all of our houses have multi-purposes. You know, even the office has someone who lives there. You know what I mean? That helps, that does two things. It defrays some of the cost of the gas and electric because he also participates financially, and it also put protection on the houses. This house has two people that live in here, so, and it serves the same purpose. We've recently started our maintenance
formalize our maintenance crew. So this is now the maintenance office. From here, the dispatcher will, you know, take job, you know, take calls for jobs as well as dispatching.
And this is maintenance of homes that you're doing in the neighborhood.
In the neighborhood. These are maintenance of homes in the neighborhood. But one of the things, one of the challenges that we really want to address is certainly some of the seniors who are being ripped off in terms of having work done and, you know, having to rely on individuals that are not, you know, I mean, reputable. We're right in the community. And our whole purpose is to help build a community, you know, here.
So now we're here in the basement of this home here on Poplar Grove. And what are we looking at?
And what we're looking at are some of the modules that we use in terms of our training program. What you're looking at now is the wiring of a house. And what will happen with this is that the class that just graduated did this. So with the new class come in, they will take it apart. And then they will learn, you mean, the process. The same back here with the plumbing. What we have done here is like made a makeshift bathroom. The plumbers set the toilet as well as the hot water heater and everything like that. So that's all part of the training. And the carpenters have their shop back there where they do prefab. You know, sometimes we have things that we make here and then, you know, we take on the job. So, but it gives them that hands-on.
And Mike, I mean, just from an epidemiological perspective, it seems to me that when we talk about programs and social programs that are intended to help various groups, there's a lot of concentration on little kids. There is a fair amount of concentration on older folks, on senior citizens, folks who may not be able to sort of fend for themselves when they get to a certain point in their lives. What is interesting to me about this program is that you're dealing with a big chunk of folks in the middle.
Tom, if you look at stable communities, I think that age group, especially males in that age group, tend to be often the one of the providers of a stable family. And I think the perception is in communities like this, which you are now characterized as mass incarceration society or communities, you find that the idea is to bring them back and stabilize their lives, and the community will prosper as a result. That's our belief, and the whole idea is to get black males an opportunity to lead the change in the community and to show others that they can do that, and that's why the focus is on that that segment of the population.
And Anton, you're in your own personal situation, and now you of course have seen your personal situation kind of reflected with the people that you're dealing with and talking to as in your capacity as a community liaison person for group ministries. But what was it in your own personal situation, your own life, that made it possible for you to sort of flip that switch and turn it around and go in a different direction? Can you identify a moment, a thing, a reason?
Well, really, I was at the end of my rope. That was one thing. And then when I went into the program and everything, I found group ministries. And group ministries, they wasn't one of them, you know, common programs. They show interest in you. And that's what attracted me to group ministries. Reverend Smith, Mr. Harris, they pretty much let you know that you can do this, you know. And they put you out there, whereas you had no other choice but to do it. So it's organizations like group ministries that gave me the insight that let me know that I could go on and move on and push on.
But being challenged was a big part of it. They had to say to you, this is up to you, you got to decide. Yeah. And that challenge was key, huh?
I was at the end of my rope. I was ready for a change. If I didn't change, I possibly would have died.
On 88.1 WYPR, you've been listening to The Lines Between Us. I'm Tom Hall reporting from the Rosemont neighborhood in West Baltimore. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.